Well, I'm glad everybody's here. Welcome. I'm excited about teaching this content and then also interacting with you guys throughout the next 6-7 weeks. What we're going to do as far as how to kind of interact is we're going to use the chat function just so it doesn't get kind of too crazy. And what the kind of program or the way I've structured this is the first 30-ish minutes or so. And you know, if you guys know me, just Anso, you know, Anso can go over a little bit, but 30 minutes or so. And then I'm going to take your questions, but don't wait until the end. Don't wait until the end to send me your questions. Feel free throughout if you have questions that pop up. And I'll use the chat box throughout. So go ahead and unmute, and I'll kind of have, once we get to the end of my lesson, I'll be kind of working through those questions on the chat box. And I'll try to do my best to get to all the questions, but I'll probably won't be able to cover them all. One important kind of housekeeping detail before we get going, and we are making a registration change for the remaining six classes. Instead of asking you to sign up for each of the remaining six classes, we're going to send you a link to a new registration page tomorrow through Eventbrite. So you'll get an email. And by registering on this page, this new email you get tomorrow, you'll be automatically registered for the remaining six classes. If you've already signed up for every class, you went ahead and did that, no worries at all. We will re-register for you. There's nothing for you to do. But you will receive a class reminder. So you'll get an email tomorrow. Go ahead and fill that out and register tomorrow, and that'll sign you up for the rest of the classes. And then from here on out, what that'll enable is not only register you, so you'll get a Zoom link, but you'll get it every Monday as a reminder, and then you can just use that Zoom link that comes your way. We're still learning this, as I know so many of you guys are too, so thanks for your patience as we try to adjust to doing this the best way. We're also gonna record the lessons, and so we'll post the recording on our website prior to the next class. So if you can't make it to one of the classes, you should find the lesson under sermons or talks on the Holy Trinity website. Just one last note, and this is one of the things we haven't announced quite yet, and so you're hearing it first tonight. One of the things we want to do as a church is really use the next 7 weeks to get us all on the same page as how we think about talking to our friends and neighbors and coworkers and family members about the gospel story. And then this is going to lead us into probably in January or February having another series of classes, but we're going to have them and they're going to specifically be aimed at people who aren't believers in the Christian faith. And we want you and others to invite them to say, hey, come and hear one of our leaders talk about meaning and love and hope and all these things that really make life worth living and significant and how Christianity relates to those things. And it's an opportunity where we want you to invite those people, but you also don't have to do all the heavy lifting, and you can kind of bring them into a course like that. Whereas this 7 weeks is specifically aimed at folks who are believers and looking to have these conversations. That next course, which we already want you to be thinking about inviting people to, is actually to engage people who we want to be talking to. So, having said that, I want to jump in, and I'm going to use a PowerPoint to talk through this. If you have, one of the things we'll do afterwards is we'll send you a kind of brief synopsis of the outline, and you don't feel like you have to feverishly try to take notes. I'd love if you just kind of listened and think about questions, and then we have a conversation at the end of this. So starting off tonight, I'm going to go through 6 points. And I think starting off, I want to talk about how we live now in an age of anxiety, that people feel the kind of pressure of our moment, and it's only been escalated in the midst of COVID and the racial tensions and everything else going. And they're feeling this need, even though they might not put it this way, they're feeling this need for faith and hope and love. And one of the things that happened as I was writing, telling a better story, I was actually finishing it up, is I got a phone call from a good friend, actually a good high school friend, one of the few high school friends I've kept in touch with. And I got a call a week after his brother had passed away. His brother actually had committed suicide. And by the time we called up and by the time he called me, he was already processing. He was a Christian, both his brother who had committed suicide was a confessing believer, and my friend is a believer. But he was already processing how to help his other brother, who was not a Christian, as he was going through this and as he was grieving, really grieving without hope. And he had watched his brother and tried to console his brother during the week and even the weeks after. And during that week, and he wasn't getting anywhere with him. He had invited his brother for years before that to come to church with him, and he had little success. I mean, his brother, it's one of these stories, and it won't sound that unfamiliar to many of you. His brother had grown up attending church, but he had gone to college and then to graduate school, and he increasingly got cynical about Christianity. It seemed far-fetched and implausible. And so my friend, he didn't really know what to do. He talked to his pastors at his church, and his pastor suggested a book. So he gave him a book, and it was a kind of standard apologetic book, and it did not go anywhere. In fact, his brother quickly kind of laughed that book off, and it wasn't effective. He didn't get any traction with it. And as my friend is on the phone describing this to me all, he was telling me, he said, "You know, I don't want to argue with my brother. I love him, and I want him to have hope. I want him to have faith. I want him to know Christ. And I just want to help navigate him so he can meet Christ and he can kind of get through these roadblocks, the skepticism that keeps him from seriously considering this." And as I was talking to him, you know, on one hand, I'm talking to him on the phone in my office, and I've got the manuscript of my book right there behind it. And I'm thinking, this is the exact person I'm writing this book for. And I think one of the things, though, as I was reflecting more on it, and this story actually got included in the book at that point, but I realized that my friend's story, although maybe not right after a family member has committed suicide, this story of trying to help someone, or wanting to, even if you haven't even tried, is really so many of our experiences. I mean, it's an experience we have. We want to have meaningful conversations with people in our lives. We want to help them discover the faith, hope, and love that is in Christ that's changed our life. And yet we're not exactly sure how to navigate those. And one of the things I wanted to start off with is to say to you in this first point is that we live in this time that, you know, secular writers have labeled the age of anxiety. The kind of we are dealing with massive despair, and I'm not going to bore you with all the statistics, but they're there. And what's clear is that in the midst of the struggles of life, people are looking for hope and love, but they're looking for these things as well as other things that make life worth living without religious faith, without Christ. And what's increasingly evident is it doesn't seem to be working. And so that's bad news, but it's also good news, right? It's bad news that people are under despair. It's bad news that under the surface, people are hurting. But what we need to see as believers is we have good news for that. And I think that changes the way we think about conversations. This is why Augustine would call the church the hospital for sinners. This is how souls could be healed. And that we have this message. Now the trick is we've got to figure out how to get there, how to have the conversation. So this leads to my second point, which is the need to reimagine our approach. And when I say approach, I'm meaning the need to reimagine our approach to conversations. Most Christian outreach strategies, and for many on this call, you've maybe you've gone through kind of different courses or different training curriculums. I certainly did. And I would just say anytime I went through various training methods, I learned things. I was helped by them. So there's many things to be gained. But I think one of the things that's happened is that as culture has shifted, we haven't shifted how we think about having these conversations. So most Christian outreach strategies kind of focused on kind of verbally sharing the gospel with people who could understand the categories, or getting unbelievers to attend huge evangelistic rallies or events, maybe being able to answer a few questions. Yet a lot of times the assumption was that unbelievers understood and shared a common framework for considering the claims of Christ. In other words, oftentimes we assumed they were kind of primed and ready and looking for something here with Jesus. And I think this approach works decently well in a culturally Christian society. When Christianity is seen as culturally good, something that can help society flourish and function well, good people went to church. Attending religious events such as revivals or church services were both implicitly and explicitly encouraged. Our society had a general respect for religion, in other words. So you could pretty much stick to having kind of surface level conversations, invite people to church, pass down our faith to our kids, and then occasionally when really tough questions came up, we could kind of refer them to the experts or throw a book at them and see if that would help. And I just want to say, things have clearly changed. That's not the cultural climate anymore. And today there's a growing social sentiment that actually discouraged people from coming to kind of churchy events, or even in many cases, even seriously considering the Christian message. So there's this massive shift that I could spend a lot of time, because I like, you know, nerdy people like me like to spend time thinking about these things, but that this shift has occurred in Western culture. And I want to skip a lot of the footnotes and kind of get to the point. I mean, now not only is God absent from the fabric of the most important institutions and cultural centers in the West, but now what we're experiencing is this array of competing views about life's most important questions. Religious belief and Christian belief, our belief in Christ, is simply one option among many. And for certain people in certain sectors and certain kind of groups, it's increasingly seen as a weird option. So this is what I'm describing is more than just a little, just, you know, small disagreements over minor details or things we can just kind of pull out, you know, here are three reasons that proves Jesus's resurrection, or this evidence just demands that you take this verdict. No, it's It feels like, and I'm, you guys can ask me, we can talk more about this in the chat time if you want, but it feels like increasingly we aren't even in the same ballpark on our thinking about life's most important questions. As we find ourselves in this kind of increasingly post-Christian culture, approaches to that assume people will come to hear a famous speaker because they're famous, are largely going to be ineffective. The more secular we get, the more they're not going to come to say, hey, we want to hear, you know, the equivalent of Billy Graham. People increasingly aren't waiting around for a relationship with God. They might feel like something's wrong. They're despairing. They feel anxiety, but they're not thinking some kind of transcendent figure, not Jesus, is going to be the answer. They're not waiting around for their sins to be forgiven. And these are some of the things that evangelistic programs, say 50 years ago, in a large part, assumed in their methodology. And kind of this big point in number two is we can't assume we're living in Christendom. And the longer we assume this as a church and as Christians, I think increasingly we are going to have trouble having conversations with our neighbors and friends. And so we need to think carefully about our approach. We need to try to avoid the tendency to kind of talk past each other. We need an approach that allows us to get what I would say in the mental register of our unbelieving friends, a way to speak their language in a way they can understand it and then point to Christ. We need to get deeper and what I would say is tap into their hearts and say, what does it really mean to be human? And how does the story that you're living, how's it actually doing? How's it actually working for you? In order so that we can turn and say, let me tell you about the Christian story. Try on the Christian story. And so this is a kind of way to reimagine our approach. And I just want to say, even though we're reimagining our approach, I'll just, for some of you who are interested in this type of thing, this approach in some way, it's reimagining something that's really ancient. Like I'm actually, you know, we've got to package this in a certain way that it kind of sings and rings for a contemporary audience. But, you know, Augustine was doing this 1600 years ago because he was living in a kind of pluralistic society that looks kind of like ours. So Augustine, though, is a little harder to understand. And so I'm not just giving you Augustine, but in some ways it's inspired by him. So this has ancient roots, the way I'm thinking about this. And I'm not just coming up with it and saying, hey, I just came up with this, but it's returning to the past and then bringing it into our context for today. Okay, so it's needing to reimagine our approach. Number three, story is a place to start. In other words, since a lot of times we're coming at this thing from, it seems like we're in different ballparks, what's some common ground? And what I'm suggesting is story is a place that we can start. Now, even as I say that, I need to deal with an objection, because for some people, they tell themselves a story, and for some people in some communities within Western society, they're telling a story that goes like this. Once upon a time, our descendants gathered around campfires and told stories to explain the world. By passing down primitive tales, they gave each other myths to provide meaning and direction in life. But now we've come of age. Science, reason, technology have freed us from the captivity of such enchanted fairy tales. We now have our computers, algorithms, and common sense reason as our guide to live better lives. And we, through these things, can make a better world. Now, of course, you maybe have already picked up what my response to this kind of objection will be. The problem with this anti-story tale, which of course, ironically, is, at least the way I told it, a story, is that no one escapes the need for stories. In fact, what we're doing and what we're seeing now is we're seeing all these new technologies to help us tell stories better. So we're inventing new mediums by which to pass them down. We might not be sitting around campfires as much, but we are sitting around Netflix, and we are sitting around Amazon Prime, and we are sitting around YouTube, and we've replaced our sage elders with new elders. The campfire looks differently, but we're still telling stories, and we're passing them down to explain life, to give our life meaning, to give our life hope. And what happens is through all the stories that we're filled, that fill our lives every day in various mediums, is that from these, people start forming big life-explaining stories. In other words, it's often through these smaller stories that we hear from advertisements to movies to songs that come at us every day that big life-explaining stories often emerge, and we end up following their scripts whether we realize we are or not. And buried within that, no matter who you are, whether you're a believer or unbeliever, there are answers to the big questions of life. Who are we? Who are we as humans? What are we supposed to be doing? What is the meaning of life? What is the foundational problem? And how can it be fixed? Is there a reason to hope? What is love? And why do I want it? These are just some of the questions that these stories that come at us and the big stories that are behind them are trying to answer. So I actually think there's this opportunity. Story's a place for us to start. But one of the things we have to learn is to learn to listen to the stories that are being told, where people are trying to get meaning and love and significance from. And we need to say, as we listen to them, we need to say, what's missing? What's actually not working? And I think I think one of the ways we do this, and one of the ways I've done this, you don't have to go about doing this, but it's to actually listen to, even in the most enlightened cultures, even in the West, is to actually read their novels and watch their movies and see what's going on. And so one of the things I was doing as I was writing this is that's one of the things I set out to do as I was watching movies. And a great example of this, to kind of give you an example of somebody doing this, is Tim Keller and in a book, he recounts how prior to the release of the Lord of the Rings movie, so this is a few years ago, he talks about how there were all of a sudden there's a host of these articles by literary critics and other cultural elites, and they're actually lamenting the popular appeal of fantasies, of myths, of legends, so many of which in their thinking were, you know, promoted regressive views. Modern people, they thought, are supposed to be more realistic. They should realize that things are not black and white, and that happy endings, life just doesn't end like that. Life's cruel. And so in this book, Keller, he actually cites a New Yorker article that chides fans of the Tolkien novels. And it says, it is a book that bristles with bravado, and yet to give into it, to cave into it, to really enjoy it, as most of us did on first reading, betrays a reluctance to face the finer shades of life and verges on the cowardly. And I think, you know, it's an interesting kind of remark. You can tell that this person's embraced what I have called before this kind of anti-story story, and particularly stories that appeal to some kind of transcendence, some kind of hope, some kind of ultimate joy that could be found. And yet, despite this kind of call for realism, what I have observed is we in the West, in all of our kind of enlightenment reasoning, we can't seem to help ourselves. So right now, you know, one of the huge movies amongst young people is, or the series among young people are Stranger Things, the Marvel superheroes, the intergenerational Star Wars craze. It reveals that no matter what our head might be saying, our heart is wanting something more, something beyond. And I would suggest that one of the things that's happened in our modern world, it's like we've inherited glasses that screen out this kind of vision of otherworldly hope and joy. And to say, no, this is just really how it is. No, don't buy into that. This is what you see is what you get, and that's it. And yet something inside of us keeps longing for something. It's like inside of us, our heart is yearning for something more, something beyond us. And so even as we live in this age where people imagine that they've cast off ancient but erroneous wisdom, I think there's something actually lacking about the wisdom of modern ideals. You know, what's actually happening is as we've turned to this world only, we're actually, that's why we're feeling the anxiety. When we cut off this kind of sacred order, what happens is it doesn't turn out well. So the pursuit of individual freedom has actually turned out to mean we lose out on true love. And we're going to talk about that in the coming weeks. We want to talk about love. No matter who you talk to, they want love. They want to be loved. And yet we pursue it by individual freedom, and it actually, so it undercuts our ability to love and be loved. We've adopted a consumerism that has led us to despair, a pop psychology that has neither removed our guilt or our anger. And so we're living in the midst of this time of deep anger and resentment. With a loss of a traditional understanding of sin, we've also lost the resources needed to actually truly forgive others and define forgiveness. And so we can't have peace. We can't have peace with God, but we can't have peace with each other either, because we don't know what forgiveness is. The cultural narratives, in other words, these stories that we hear in our culture, oftentimes they promise something and they pick up on human aspirations that are good and right, and it's part of what it means to be human. But the way they go about fulfilling those and the path they chart for modern people to fulfill those lead us to a very different place than heaven on earth. Although that's the promise, heaven on earth, it never leads there. And so one of the things that we have to do is we have to learn to listen well to what I think the brightest and the most open atheist and secular people are saying. And I want to give you one of those people. Salman Rushdie is a world-renowned novelist and self-proclaimed hardline atheist. So he is no friend to religion here. But he admits religion's ability to satisfy certain human needs better than the secular scripts. This is what he says. It's important that we understand how profoundly we all felt the needs that religion down the ages has satisfied. I would suggest that these needs are of three types. First, the need to be given an articulation of our half-glimpsed knowledge of exaltation, of awe, of wonder. Life is an awesome experience. And religion helps us to understand why life so often makes us feel small by telling us what we are smaller than. And contrarywise, because we also have a sense of being special, of being chosen. Religion helps us by telling us what we've been chosen by and what for. Secondly, we need answers to the unanswerable. How did we get here? How did here get here in the first place? In this brief life, is this brief life all there is? How can it be? What would be the point of that? And thirdly, we need codes to live by, rules for every bleeping thing. The idea of God is at once a repository for our awestruck wonderment at life and an answer to the great questions of existence, and a rule book too. The soul needs all these explanations, not simply rational explanations, but explanations of the heart. It is important to understand how often the secular rationalistic materialism, basically saying atheism, has failed to answer these needs. So in other words, I think with someone like Salman Rushdie here, who again is no friend to Christianity or religion, he is recognizing that there's things missing on the storylines and the scripts that they've inherited, the secular scripts. And what we're going to do in this series of lessons is I want to help you pick up on what's missing in your neighbor's lives and in your friends' lives, and learn how to ask questions, not to trap them, but to talk about life and talk about meaning and talk about what's really important, to help them and even to come alongside them, to help them see where their own storylines that they're living out are actually faltering, and then to invite them. Not in a way that, you know, tries to back them into a corner and coercively pressures them, but just invites them with joy. Come and taste and see. This is the story that for 2,000 years has been changing lives, and it will give you the faith, hope, and love you're looking for. Number five, my fifth point is the story lives on. And I want to give you some examples to help illustrate how I actually think story as a category helps us in a particular way. And the first one is Harry Potter. And listen, I just want to say this to everybody, and this might get me in some trouble, but Harry Potter, it's not an evil series, okay? there's lots you can learn. Like anything, you should read it critically. But I have my kids read Harry Potter. And one of the things about the Harry Potter series is it shows us how echoes of the gospel persist in many of our culture's most beloved stories. And the Harry Potter series is the best-selling book series of all time. International, billions and billions have sold, and of course the movie series. And yet the author, J.K. Rowling, explains this about her series. She says, "To me, the religious parallels have always been obvious." Now, if you don't know the story, I'm about to tell you, because it's old and you should know something about it anyway. So the story is framed by two acts of sacrificial love. The mother who gave her life, and by the way, so if you need to mute me, if I just encouraged you to do this, and then I'm about to tell you, you know, the plot line, you can mute me for a second, and I'll give away when you can come back. So, but here it is. The story is framed by two acts of sacrificial love. A mother who gave her life to save her son, and the son who willingly goes to his death so that all those he loves would live. The savior of the story is, of course, Harry Potter, the young wizard, whose life had always been leading to the moment he would allow himself to be struck by evil unto death, only to live and return to defeat evil. Okay, you can come back if you muted me. Now, it doesn't take a literary critic to realize that story significantly mirrors the story of Christ. And if you're still not convinced, I can show you later the quotes of J.K. Rowling where she says this exact thing, that it mirrors the story of Christ. And my point here is it's not just, I made the point earlier about I was making the point that we're storing animals, and so we can't escape story. But here I'm giving you another good piece of news for us. It's that non-believers tell their stories, inhabit stories to explain the world, to hope for a better day, to warn of evils, and somewhere in the distance looms God's story. I mentioned before in my interview with JY a week or so ago about this atheist, Julian Barnes, and he says, "I don't believe in God, but I miss him." And I didn't unpack that as much as I could have, and I just want to give you this this quote from, this is James K. Smith talking about this. He says, he's quoting here Barnes. He says, the Christian religion didn't last so long merely because everyone believed it, Barnes observes. It lasted because it makes for a hell of a novel, which is pretty close to Tolkien's claim that the gospel is true because it is the most fantastic fantasy, the greatest fairy story ever told. And Barnes, a great lover of both music and painting, knows that much of what he enjoys owes its existence to Christianity. Thus, he finds himself asking, and here's the question. This is the question I want us to get there with people in our lives. What if it were true? What if it were true? What would it be like, he asked, to listen to Mozart's Requiem and take it as nonfiction? The examples could go on. And I'm going to, just for the sake of time, we can share these power. Well, I'll give you this. So John Stuart Mill is another example of this. He is the founder of kind of secular humanism. And John Gray, who's, again, not a Christian by any stretch of the imagination, but he's talking about John Stuart Mill, and this is what he says. He says, Mill was unusual not having been reared in a traditional faith. But like everyone else in mid-Victorian England, he was shaped in his thinking and feelings by Christianity. When he insisted that morality did not depend on religion, he invoked an idea of morality that was borrowed from Christian religion. When he affirmed that humankind was improving, he was relying on the belief that the humankind is a collective moral agent, an idea that also derives from Christianity. It's things like this, quotes people like John Stuart Mill and observations like Gray is mentioning here, which is why Friedrich Nietzsche, who himself, again, critic of Christianity, wrote about the atheists in his day, and he said that even these secular men weren't free from the Christian story. He says they haven't escaped it. The morality, the assumptions they're making about the world is still buried within those. It's the Christian story is still buried. So that leads us to my final point for this evening, and that's a better story about stories. So let me summarize a little bit in more bullet point fashion where we've been tonight. At first, I started talking, after I've talked about the kind of general landscape, I said that there was this problem with this thin anti-story tale that says, well, we've come of age and we no longer need stories and we just can use our reason and our ration and our kind of algorithms and our computer and our scientific thinking, and that will solve all our problems and that will get us at the heart of what is truly meaningful about life, and that's what we need. And I've said several things. I said, first, stories are unavoidable for us as humans. So this is who we are as humans. We are going to tell stories. And in fact, one scholar puts it like this. She says, there have been great societies that did not use the will, but there have been no societies that did not tell stories. And so despite the cries of those who claim that we as modern enlightened people should come of age and simply kind of just logic chop our way to truth, story remains our lingua franca, our kind of common way to communicate, our universal language. And so over the next 6 weeks, I'm going to lean into story and thinking as a lens about how to communicate and how to talk to people about the gospel and how to get on their kind of register. We're going to be using story. Second, the point I was making before is our culture continues to be captured by imaginative stories that point to our inherent longing for another world. We'll talk about that some more and how we might use those in the coming weeks. Third, through the stories we love to hear and tell, from Mozart's Requiem, as Barnes was talking about, to liberal humanism's moral tale, to universal love, to J.K. Rowling's story of sacrificial death and resurrection, again, this is good news. We're reminded that even in a post-Christian culture, even in a culture that kind of looks back at Christianity and says, no, we've been through that and we don't want to go back, people still can't escape the echoes and at times the allure of the gospel story. So we need what I would say a better story about stories. Why do humans of all cultures and all times insist on telling stories? Why do otherworldly tells, that are second point there, continue to capture our imagination, even though we're supposed to be living in this disenchanted age? Why do themes of guilt and sacrifice and redemption and resurrection remain palpable, even in the midst of the secular corners of our contemporary world? Well, to sum up, J.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, who were both friends at Oxford at the same time, and wrote really many of their great novels at a pub there and worked through those together. One of the things that they both saw is that there is a narrative embedded within the deeper structures of the created order, which enables and shapes and molds the construction and narration of human story. In other words, what they saw is that there was a divine narrative found within the created order, especially the human imagination. And so human potentiality is not reached by giving up on stories. We can't do that, but it's about learning how to embrace the right story, the story that actually fulfills all the other stories, that fulfills our deepest longings as humans. And so even amidst all the shifts, the challenges that we face with these conversations, we continue to tell this story. And the key is learning to tell it in a way that matches up with these, what I call universal features of personhood. And so for the next 6 weeks, that's what we're going to be diving into doing. This first lecture, I'm going to turn off my my screen share now. This first lecture was really to set up the next six and give you guys kind of the structure. And then where I want to move into for the next 6 weeks is really practical. You know, how do we use meaning and love and significance in these things to have conversations? But I wanted to see, I felt like before we could just jump into that, I needed to show you guys the problem of how past conversations we were trying to force a model from 50 or 60 years ago to how now we can do this in a way that both learns from the past and yet picks up on these key features of personhood. So I'm going to jump to chat. And I'll just try to start plugging away here. Yeah, so one question came in. I appreciate it. There's some really good questions here, and I'll just try to go through these. There's a divide with talking with lower income people, more blue collar background. And I found that they tend to have a framework that higher income white collar background folks I've talked to with often lack. It's almost like the more comforts people can afford, the easier it is to question, stop believing God. And I would just say I think that's one of the threads I mentioned before. It's a long story, but that's one of the threads with a modern society. So with modernity and the Enlightenment came technologies and eventually post-industrial age, which generated, obviously, it could generate lots of affluence in a way that we'd never seen in the history of the West or history of the world. But with that, obviously, people, when you're comfortable in life, and you don't have death rates with your children, and you have, you all of a sudden don't feel like, hey, why do I need God? And you feel like you have control over your own life. I have control. I've got money. I'm healthy, and we put all these kind of things to control life. Of course, there's some sense where you certainly do have more control, but it's not ultimate control. And so I think one of the things that why COVID has opened this door is all of a sudden people are scared. And they realize, at least for a while there, especially at the beginning, hey, this, we don't know anything about this. And so all of a sudden there's these fears that are being provoked. And I think that because modernism has brought that, I mean, one of the things that I think we should use in a way, in a gracious way, but to be able to talk to people about death. Death is, Ecclesiastes says, it's better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of celebration because it sobers us up to the reality. So I do think part of the conversation when we meet somebody who says, well, I just don't really care, is to get to some of these things that, you know, what happens when you die? And then sometimes from there, people go to, well, I just rot in the ground, so I'm not scared of it. But again, as I mentioned on the interview with John, I actually don't believe that, because what makes life so worth living is, I think, relationships and these experiences. And death is actually the end of that, and it casts a shadow over all of that. So I do think, kind of at times, when we build a relationship, to go there can help in those situations. But you're certainly right, that is a challenge. Let me keep going. Yeah, I think, thanks for this question. Somebody was pointing out that it's one of the things that's changed is that there's a perception that Christians aren't just out of touch with everybody else and the things that are good, but that they're on the wrong side. And so, and I probably didn't elaborate on this as much. I know I didn't elaborate on it as much as I could have, but we're dealing with this situation now where, yeah, it's not just that we're out of touch, but we're the problem. And I don't, you know, in Raleigh, I think that's a mix. I think it's a mix still. I think if you go up to Seattle, it's probably a different conversation. I think there is some of that certainly in Raleigh. And I think certainly in the downtown area, if we're going to jump in and be a light in this place the Lord has called us to, we will increasingly deal with this objection. And it's often because of this objection that people won't consider if it's true, because they don't think it's good. So oftentimes that's why I suggest, even this is why it can be more effective to say, hey, imagine if this were true. Actually, do you see how this is good? But then if we don't embody that with our lives, if we don't embody that with caring for them, even in how we have this conversation, recognizing that when I have a conversation with someone, it's not just the words they say, but how I say it that actually says something. And so that tone really does matter. But then more than that, to be out in our community and serving is really important to provide context for then when we speak this gospel message. Yeah, somebody was asking me about the Rushdie quote. What does he see as the answers? Well, he doesn't have good answers. of course, I'm a Christian theologian, so that's what I would say. But he kind of explores novels and how novels and writing can kind of help with these things. But he doesn't, at least in that little piece, a little lecture he gave back in 1990, which I'm quoting for, I don't think he had really firm answers to this. And I think it's a perennial, and I think this is the push and pull. The reality is that most atheists out there aren't Richard Dawkins and the New Atheists. They actually feel the pull. They feel the fragile, they wonder what if, And so sometimes we approach, and when somebody says we're an atheist, we just imagine they're going to be really mean and antagonistic. And I don't think that that is often the case. And if they are, it's only an opportunity to engage them and love them with a different tone. But somebody, what's the connection with story and worldview? They're intertwined. They're intertwined. And I think that the worldview, I've been talking more about story rather than worldview. I think one of the differences, well, let me speak on a practical level. At one level, people, if you ask somebody what the worldview is, you know, a lot of people will just kind of look at you. In other words, blankly. And if you, but if you ask them, hey, what's your story? Or where do you find, you know, meaning, and where do you find value? Or, you know, tell me about your life. They're going to tell you a story. They naturally think in story, even if they haven't taken the next step to articulate a worldview, where everything came from. Let me give you kind of these abstract categories to answers. Maybe I haven't fully fleshed out. But if you tell them, but they would certainly tell you their story and what they find valuable and why they find it valuable and meaningful. So I find that story and worldview are often connected. Oftentimes story can work on a precognitive level, where typically worldview I would describe as something you actually have to, people have to, you know, they're going to work out. It's something more that they've thought through and affirm certain things. At least that's how I see a helpful distinction between the two. Yeah, I appreciate this question. What if we really are the problem at times? In other words, what if it's not just perception? What if it's reality? And I think when that is the case, we have to own it. And this is what I would call a public. I think it's not the only thing we do, right? I don't think we just lower our head and say, you know, oh goodness, you know, the Crusades, we're sorry, and never say anything else. Okay. But we have to own it. We have to own it. And we have to say, but we also know a God who forgives and restores. And so what you actually see within Christian history, well, first of all, I want to say to that person, you are absolutely right to call me out on my hypocrisy or our community's hypocrisy, as you see it. That's fine. But by what standard are you doing that? Because often they're saying, well, you're not living up to your standards. And I just want to say, that's fair and that's right. But then, you know, what other standard is there? I mean, what standard do you have? What is a kind of transcendent standard? And I would actually say that Christianity within it, within the story, actually has given us the resources to self-correct. And so, yes, Christians were part of the problem with slave trade in the South, in America. But we also need to say that Christianity was the force that brought change. William Wilberforce and the Clapham sect in England, and the Quakers in North America. So that doesn't mean that today we don't have blind spots and issues that we still need to be repenting of and evaluating. But I think even our openness that, hey, we are people who know we can be wrong. That is something you don't see quite as much. So I do think that there is a kind of apologetic that it comes with this type of repentance, while at the same time, not just being pushovers. And I think recognizing that in history, Christianity has brought these gifts to the world. And that's a good story to be told. And that Christianity has brought correction when Christians have gone wrong. And if you don't have a story that transcends kind of your cultural milieu or the script that you're living out, then you will never have something to correct and get you back on track. other than the kind of spirit of the age. And I think that's a real problem. And it's why you even have secular people now who are saying, you know, I'm not buying actually the big metaphysical, the philosophical claims of Christianity, but I kind of like the West when it was more Christian. And what they're saying with that, and these aren't, as I said, Douglas Murray, the British, he's an atheist, but he's saying this too, that the kind of secular gods that we've embraced, that he would say there seems to be something about the human heart, that there's a hole that only there's a God-shaped hole that needs to be filled. And he said the problem with how we're filling it these days is they're more brutal than, much more brutal than the God of Christianity. And they don't seem to be treating us very well. And so I think we need to own up to when we as Christians haven't lived out a life that's like Christ. But at the same time, I think we want to say these other stories and these other gods you're worshiping are going to treat you very brutally. And so there's lots of questions, and there'll be six more weeks of this. I'm sorry I didn't get to them all. One of the things that I want to do in this course is make sure we get out right at 8. I'm gonna work hard. And we have some glitches getting going tonight, so we'll clean that up, and we'll work to have more time for Q&A at the end. So thanks again for joining us. Remember, you should get an email tomorrow, and that email will give you, it'll be, hopefully this is the last time you'll be able to click on that, and then it'll register you for the next six sessions, and then you'll get an email every Monday with a new Zoom link. I'm really sorry for everyone who had trouble getting on tonight, and we'll work to clean these up, and hope to see you next week. So God bless, and talk to you soon.